is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. And it's a great honor.
News for the Soul is now in its 25th year of broadcasting. Tune in live or visit the archives at newsforthesoul.com. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Next on News for the Soul, Transformational Learning with Diane Hill. Diane is a member of the Bear Clan of the Mohawk Nation, situated at the Six Nations of the Grand River Territory in Ontario. Diane works as an integrative programs consultant and administrates the Real School Leadership Program and runs a private healing lodge and learning center focusing on fostering emergence. Her teachings integrate an indigenous worldview and with discoveries drawn from the quantum sciences, bridging the Western allopathic scientific perspective and the ancient indigenous multidimensional approach to wholeness. Please welcome back Diane Hill to News for the Soul.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. It's nice to be back on the air today and to have a new guest on my show. That gentleman has the name of Craig Abatosile, and Craig is the health director of the Manadzilin Health Services. So I'd like to introduce Craig, and he can introduce himself some more because I'm not even sure I said that right. Craig, are you out there?
I am. Thank you, Diane, for the invite to be a part of your show today.
You're welcome.
The pronunciation, agency pronunciation was pretty good. It's Manadzilin Health Services. And in our language in Ojibwe, it refers to the good life, Manadzilin. So we are a health service, health access center located on Manitoulin Island. And we service the First Nations in the surrounding area on the island in a variety of multidisciplinary type professions.
Wow. Craig, I know that you've got something like 5 First Nations that you're servicing through the health center. And some of those services are what we call, or we would know as conventional health services. So like there's a access to family physicians, there's access to nurse practitioners, access to nurses, that kind of thing. And but you also have personal support workers, I think, on staff there, and some other special services that fall into the category of what we would call Native traditional healing and Native traditional healing practices. So I'm just wondering today if we could explore, Craig, what your perspective is on Native traditional healing, just to give the listeners in the audience some understanding of when we go into that realm of Native traditional healing, how do you see it and how has it worked? Because I know you do have traditional healers come into your center there, and your agency is quite involved in ceremonies for non-Native staff. That's what I think is really special about what you're doing there, is that non-Native staff get to have spirit names, and they have the opportunity to find clans and to speak Ojibwe and to really embrace indigenous knowledge and pieces of indigenous culture while they're employed with you. So I just thought, let's start with Native traditional healing. What is that? How do you see that from your own perspective?
I think when we look at the various approaches, the healing methods that are out there, when we look at the history of how healing has developed throughout time, it's always emerged out of indigenous practice. And indigenous practice is something we've worked at defining here at Manadzilin Health Services. It's something that all people can relate to. When we take away the cultural perspectives and the First Nations perspectives, we're left with indigenous approaches to health. And that is something, when we look at history, is rooted in all cultures worldwide. So when we start looking at that, we start engaging in an idea of inclusiveness with all staff and inclusiveness with all clients that we're servicing here on Manitoulin Island, without getting specific to First Nations services. So one of the big pieces that I brought forward to the agency when I came in here, because I have a background in formal education with a master's degree from Wilfrid Laurier University down in your area. But with that, I've explored in depth a lot of what I bring to the table from a personal perspective, which is the Anishinaabe practices and ceremonies that I've been engaged in for 30 plus years now as a First Nations individual and practitioner. So when we explore Indigenous health practice, then we look at trying to find relevance in a modern setting to see how it can relate and complement the First Nations practices. So it's not enough that Indigenous practice or the traditional forms of practice be a supplement and just a token piece to what we're doing. We've really worked at Namadzu in finding a relevant place in a modern setting to the work that we're doing here. So we really strive towards the balance between both the Western world and the traditional world views that are present in Indigenous practice. So with that, we've explored what opportunities and possibilities are present there in defining those practices. And we engage in contracts with three different traditional healers who have various disciplines in how they approach healing from a traditional Indigenous perspective. And our healers historically are no different than mainstream healers. Because in mainstream, there are foot doctors, there's heart surgeons, there's brain surgeons, there's orthopedic doctors, psychiatry, and all of these various disciplines. So the same thing applies for us as Anishinaabe people, that when we start looking at historical Indigenous practices, we had all those practices that went back thousands of years. So it's been an exercise in our part, just bringing those forward and trying to make the connections to show the relevance in a modern setting.
That's wonderful.
I'm gonna kind of stop there.
Yeah, you did. But it was good because you gave the audience, an insight, I'll say, into understanding that Native traditional healing isn't just like people doing ceremonies or singing you a song or praying for you or that like people see these images, you know, and they get most of their information from TV and movies and that kind of thing. But to have someone like yourself come online and come on the air today and be able to sort of say, hey, wait a minute, we've got diverse practices here. Some of them can fall in line with specialty practices that you find in mainstream Western culture. That's really key. And so when you say that I think opens up the window to a lot more possibilities for traditional healers and themselves, as well as helping mainstream people understand that, oh, okay, there's not kind of one size fits all. There's going to be a number of individuals with their specialties, and you're going to have to really get to know these people or come to question them in such a way so that you're not sort of saying traditional healing is just all about the sweat lodge. That's only one part of traditional healing. Healing, I think, can go into many different wings and many different services, right, other than just a sweat lodge. But I know from people's experiences and my travels in mainstream, people tend to, everybody wants to go to the sweat lodge, for example. They think that is it is the way that Native people are going to do their healing work. And the sweat lodge is really only just one aspect of it. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, there's definitely a notion when we use the word traditional healer or elder in our communities that it's a one size fits all, that one healer can heal all aspects of an individual. So we try to create that awareness that there is just as much diversity in Indigenous healing practices as there is in the mainstream world, while at the same time trying to point out that the missing aspect of mainstream healing practices is the lack of acknowledgement of the spiritual side of healing. So it's one thing
yes.
we speak predominantly about but it's misconstrued as being the only piece that we have to bring to the table, and that's also not a true aspect of it. We're trying to, if there's one thing we're trying to create awareness of in Indigenous practice, it's the need to be holistic. It's the need to be considering all aspects of self, of being, of the world as we know it, being the mental, spiritual, physical, and emotional. So
yes.
If in one perspective we can say that, then it's that First Nations people are very strong in the spiritual side of things, given this idea that we just go into Sweat Lodge and do a lot of these spiritual practices. But we have academics in our various disciplines also who spend years, much more time than a doctor might spend in medical school, learning about the scientific and physical properties just of medicine in nature as we know it. And those types of individuals are engaged in a very academic process that's very, very much void of spiritual type engagement or practices. So there is a definite balance or diversity in Indigenous practice and practitioners who engage in both academic practice, like you might see in the mainstream, but also a heavy involvement in spiritual practice.
Let's talk about that. That is an example, Craig, that one where you said that we have some of our Native practitioners who have spent years, say, studying plant medicine, for example. Let's talk about the spiritual component of plant medicine and healing with working with plants and herbs, because I think some people think it's just as simple as going out and just picking the plant and drying it and mulching it up and then making a tea out of it. But there's more to it. Like you said, there's a spiritual side to it. I just wonder if you could comment around that spiritual side of the plant medicine.
Yeah, there's always been an ancient understanding in Indigenous practice that all things in life are living. But when we look at that word, we have to recognize and realize that we're talking in a Western type of construct, being English. And when we use the word living, there's a deeper meaning to that, and it's referencing that all things in life are in movement. But when we bring the science into the understanding of Indigenous practice, and if you start looking at the simple basic sciences around the structure of an atom, anybody that's involved in the science world knows that there is no such thing as solidity in life. Even the hardest substances like iron and crystals and various substances are simply atoms that have their moving pieces moving at a very slow rate. So that's always been an ancient Indigenous practice that all things are living, but by virtue of that, they're talking about all things are moving. So all things in life are moving has always been our understanding. And when we look at movement in life, it means that there's life present in all structures in the world. So Indigenous practice has this mindset then that even something that is considered solid, such as a rock, is a bit of a foreign construct for the average person, because they don't, their human eyes can't see the minor details of that structure that's moving at a very slow rate. So for us as First Nations people, we've always lived by that understanding that all things have life present in it, and as such, all parts of life need to be created or treated with respect. So anytime that we approach the different elements in life, whether it be water, fire, earth, or air, there's always this idea in mind that these are living substances, that there's life present in them, and that they need to be treated equally in terms of how they're approached, like you would a human being.
So yeah, and they're also then they're also conscious. And intelligent, right? You acknowledge them as conscious and intelligent beings.
Yeah, then we get to the next level of consciousness next. And is there an idea of consciousness present with these? When we start looking into these possibilities, we're starting to getting into the talk now of energy, frequency, and vibration, that the reality in all substances in life is that there's a consciousness. There's an actual relationship that can be developed with these, which is another ancient Indigenous concept, which a lot of scientists have reverted into the study of Indigenous practices. Dr. Emoto, for one of them, engaged in a very profound study that became accepted or looked into worldwide and further expanded on. But the idea of talking to water, which is based on an original concept that he came across, that indigenous people pray to the water, talk to the water. And in our ceremony, mm-hmm. we call that a purification ceremony, but it's simply developing and acknowledging a relationship with another living consciousness that's out there, which is water.
Yes.
So in those studies, he proved had shown through numerous types of studies that simply having a respectful engagement, a respectful relationship with water, you can change the molecular structure of that water, which we call purification, so that it is a much healthier substance when we drink it as a part of our ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
And then that further expands into this idea of plant life then. So we're getting to the question about medicine then. If this same principle is to be applied then, there always has been an ancient understanding that when we go to a plant to take the medicine, we need to have that same acknowledgement and respect present to speak to that medicine, to explain to that medicine what it is we're going to be using it for. This idea of reciprocity, of asking that medicine for its purpose in life, which is healing, to help that individual with the healing opportunity or the healing request that they're looking for, that there's then a purification that takes place in that reciprocity, where the plant engages in a higher level of energy, if we can call it that, or frequency, if we can call it that, where that plant medicine then is performing at its highest potential. The opposite of that is just going into the bush and grabbing some medicine out of the forest without having that conversation, without treating it with respect, and then bringing that medicine into a science lab or under a microscope and expecting the same outcomes. Science has now proven through Dr. Yamoto studies and a number of other ones that I can talk about, which I talk about in length in my Indigenous practice presentation, that there's less significance then that can come out of the medicines, which is based on Indigenous practice of just simply going into the forest, grabbing something and taking it back into the lab. Indigenous practice doesn't forget those crucial steps. So when we go into the forest, we take that time to pay our respects to that medicine and ensure that we're getting the most out of it.
Mm-hmm. And what does the medicine give? Like, the medicine gives us healing, and then what do we give back for the medicine? What do we have to make sure we give back? What would that be?
One of the most important aspects we teach in Indigenous practice when I'm doing cultural orientation, speaking to people, is this idea of payment in life. There's a simple teaching in Indigenous practice that there is no such thing as free things in life, that we always have to pay for all things in life regardless of what it is. And for us as Anishinaabe people in Ojibwe country, that payment comes in the form of tobacco. So one of the teachings that I talk about with tobacco is that tobacco is the universal dollar. And just like the universal dollar in life, that there is no such thing as free things in life, whether that's going to McDonald's or going to the Canadian Tire store, that we have to give something in trade for what somebody has created, and that's in the form of a dollar. That mm-hmm. dollar simply represents an age-old ancient practice that we always have to give for something that we're getting in return in life. And for us as Anishinaabe people, that's always been understood as tobacco. So the simple idea of even going on the water, to go into the water nation's territory, to go into the lakes around any area, we give thanks for that. We give thanks for the ability to put our boat in that water, that it's not dried up, that it's pure, that it's clean. And the same practice goes, whether that's going into the tree nation's territory, that before we go into that bush area and that territory, that we put our tobacco down to give thanks, which is no different than that simple exercise that when you enter an amusement park in a city, you got to give that universal dollar, again being the paper bill, to go and enjoy the amusements in that park. So it's the same thing in nature, that we always have to have payment present to give appreciation for all of what Mother Nature has provided. and that comes in the form of that tobacco. So before we can take the raspberries out of the fruit section of the grocery store in nature, just like going into a grocery store, we got to put our tobacco down before we take those raspberries or take that sweetgrass or take that cedar from the land to ensure that there's reciprocity there and that we're paying some respects and honoring their role in creation and that we get the most out of that.
Yeah,
when we don't
so tobacco.
That, we get something different.
Yes, that's true. And tobacco is primary, and you can add other things to that tobacco offering as well, right?
Yes, tobacco comes, and I keep referring for my territory here. I'm in Anishinaabe territory here on Manitoulin Island and in this region of area that's called Ontario, that we have four medicines that were the first four medicines to show up in creation when the earth was young and plants were showing up on the landscape and flowers and different things were starting to pop up in the early days, that it was the tobacco, the sage, the cedar, and the sweetgrass that were showing up first on the landscape. So those are our first four medicines that we combine at times in terms of offerings. It always starts with tobacco, with each of them having their own teaching, but it always starts with tobacco as that universal dollar, that gift that we give back to creation to pay our respects for what it is we get on a daily basis. And then if we want to strengthen that or add to it, it's like adding a $5 bill to the loonie. When we want to strengthen the offering towards creation, we in mainstream, they might put a $5 bill, a $10 bill, or a $20 bill in there. We could add at times. We can add more tobacco or we can add some of the other four medicines at times to bring strength to what it is we're providing in life.
Or you can add cloth offerings as well, eh? You can make those cloth offerings.
So the list, yes, it goes on. It starts with tobacco and then it comes into cloth and it goes from there. There's food offerings that come into place. There's the offering of song. There are the four elements that the first four gifts that the Creator gives to each human being coming into this world, and that song is the offering of voice. So there's the offering of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
The age-old practice of the fasting ceremony teaches us that we have to give those original gifts that we've received as individuals back to creation, and that those gifts are prayer, song, tobacco, pipe, smoking of our pipe, and giving those back. So we add different forms of not sometimes materialistic, but even non-materialistic. And that simple gift of praying is a gift back to creation also. The gift of singing is a gift back to creation also.
Yes, and that's what I find really beautiful about our culture is that if only you had was a pinch of tobacco, and if you had your voice and you could sing a song, that was equally as valuable or meaningful, even with just a small pinch of tobacco with a song, for example. And you could give that because it's coming from the heart, eh? And that's what I've always, when I'm traveling and when I'm working, I'm always telling people that your culture, your people probably say it the best, because that offering coming through the heart, which is the ode, I think is how you say it, and that heartfelt offering is coming from the ode, which is giving it the power, is giving it the I don't know, I always struggle with the word power, but it gives it some strength, to your thanks and your thanksgiving. The gratitude just can become so immense if the more heartfelt that you are.
Yeah, and there's a lot of key significant words you've used in that short little description, which are very significant, and that's the heart piece, the ode amen for our strawberries, ode wagon for our drums. It's a section or part of the verbal description of a lot of our sacred items, that little word of ode. And then even when we talk about that all of what we do as offerings is about honor and respect. And when we look at our seven grandfather teachings, the first teaching we always talk about is that idea of respect, because you can't have love towards a child without having respect first. You can't have love towards a spouse or a partner unless you understand what that respect is. A lot of people have what's called false love by thinking they're in love with an individual or their child, but they in turn don't show that in the form of respect in how they treat their loved ones or how they treat their partners. So respect becomes the cornerstone of all teachings of Indigenous practice, and that's what that simple offering of tobacco is, or that offering of prayer is. It's a form of showing respect for what it is the Creator has provided. And another word for that is honor.
Honor, yeah. And showing respect to the relationship, like to that conscious being, hey? So it's the Creator, but also the plants. When we started our conversation on plants, it can be just to that simple plant, whether I'm picking sage or whether I'm picking, everlasting flower or whatever I'm taking, I'm actually engaging in that respectful relationship with the plant itself, and then to the greater Creator that everything, including us, is connected to. Did I follow that?
Yeah, that's very much it. It's very much it, and we're getting into that as to how we engage in Indigenous practice at Namadzwan Health Services. Respect has to be a cornerstone of how each of our employees goes out and provides service to the five First Nations that we put out there. We talk in length about the expectations of working for Namadzwan Health Services when people first join us, that we're, as managers, we're not looking to hear how you saw 20, 30 clients in a given day or a given week and that you completed all your charting. We're looking to find out that you spent 20 to 30 minutes with each of those clients and you took the time to respect them, to honor them, to get to know them so that you've built that relationship again. So that idea of honor and respect starts becoming understood in the form of Indigenous practice in a modern setting then.
Mm-hmm. Well, Craig, you and I have known each other for a number of years now, a few years now, and I've done some workshops for you. And I know I've always been impressed when I go there to Namadzwan at just how some people would say, that health center is privileging, Indigenous people's knowledge and not realizing that how many years we've been under mainstream Western kind of practices that were privileged beyond ours, and we were expected to follow mainstream. And when I go to Namadzwan, I'm really impressed because everybody gets to follow Indigenous practices and Indigenous ways of knowing things and this key concept of relationship. And that's really, I can really see that in how you're guiding and how you're moving all staff, Native and non-Natives, towards that ultimate relationship, which is, the like you said, a cornerstone of Indigenous practice, is respect and then the love that you're able, and then the reciprocity, the giving and taking and giving back from what you've received. That I find is probably where it's clear, I guess I could say, when I go there. So not only is it impressive and people get a chance to practice it, they actually get to live it and employ it, like integrate it into their work, okay?
Yeah, there was a question. I've been involved in Indigenous practice ceremonies, cultural practices, going to powwows and sweat lodge and different things for, as I said, 30 plus years now. And about 10 years ago, I went back to school to get my master's degree. And one of the professors on day one asked me that one question, which was, what makes you Indigenous? And she followed it up by saying, and I don't want you to give me the answer about how you go to powwows and you sit at a drum. I want to know a deeper question of what makes you Indigenous. And then she further followed up to say, I'm not looking for the answer today. I just want you to think about that. I didn't get the answer to that question at the start of that course, but I came across her just recently in the last year again, and we've been re-engaging. We revisited that question, her and I, and we've been having some long dialogue about what I've come to realize about that question that she put on the table to all of us students at one time. And my initial response would have been, if I was having to answer that on that day, was the moccasins I wear, the long, the braids that I braid, and the songs that I sing when I'm sitting at the drum. But I've come to understand a deeper understanding of that, which is that Indigenous practice is about inclusiveness. It's embedded in how we as First Nations people first greeted any strangers that we come across, whether that be the first settlers and the Thanksgiving story about the first settlers that arrived on Turtle Island and the First Nations people that had to feed those early settlers and things like that, that we always engaged in what we call Indigenous practice, which is inclusiveness.
Yes.
So there's a distinct difference then between what Indigenous practice is and what cultural practices are. And the cultural practices is what defines me as Anishinaabe person. So I have a different definition of Anishinaabe worldview that I talk about to all of our staff. But we unpack that deeper to define Indigenous worldview also. And when you look at Indigenous worldview, then we can start, and the idea of inclusiveness, we can start realizing that all people of the world come from a historical, and we're talking historical being hundreds and hundreds of years back, if not thousands of years, that they all started in an Indigenous-based view of the world, similar to us here on Turtle Island. So by virtue of that, all people then are Indigenous, and all people are included in the form of thought that we have here on Turtle Island, and that through their historical practices, they are very similar to us here on Turtle Island if they look at those age-old historical practices of sitting in circle and being of the land and talking to the trees and carrying themselves with respect and honor of creation and all of those pieces. So at Namadjuan, we unpack that so that our staff, regardless of their skin color, feel inclusive and a part of the Indigenous practice that we engage in as an agency then.
Mm-hmm. So that really removes the tendency for people to be what they call racist or prejudiced, right, against other people, because you're looking at the real meaning of, say, what it means to be Anishinaabe, and you're breaking it down and saying, well, this applies to all human beings. It's the beings in the form of human beings. And so, therefore, we're all human beings, and so, therefore, this practice, this understanding, these relationships, these values, they apply to everybody across the board. That's what I'm hearing when I'm listening.
Yeah, when we start taking away the cultural practices of Anishinaabe people, so in Anishinaabe worldview, the cultural practice of sweat lodge, of drumming, of smudging and carrying the feather and all of these different practices that seem to define Anishinaabe people. There are cultural practices that define us. There are cultural practices that define Haudenosaunee people. And we start pulling those pieces away. There are actual Indigenous practices that tie all nations together. And Indigenous practices are simply a worldview. It has nothing to do with the physical structures that we engage in or processes. It has to do with the worldview that we have and how we see the world. And those are the pieces we try to unify all of our staff in at Namadjuan to have them realize that we have to have an Indigenous worldview and look at the world differently if we're going to practice in an Indigenous way in a modern setting. And we started unpacking all of that. One of the papers that I wrote when I was in school, and I was deeply plagued by this idea of what makes me Indigenous, when that professor made that question on that first day of one of the early classes I was in, was exploring what does the ancient words of nationhood translate to in what we call a universal language being English. Mm-hmm. And I started exploring just Anishinaabe in itself and going to the various linguistics and elders who speak the ancient language of our people. I started seeing a commonality in all of these ancient languages, and Anishinaabe being first simply means one of the definitions is a good person, a good human being. Another one they said means first man, first human being. And then a third one was Lord from the heaven down to this earth. They were talking about it being a spirit, and that's it. It didn't reference two braids. It didn't reference skin color. It didn't reference geography. All of those definitions in a universal language of English simply meant being a human being, being good, being of a good spirit, being a spirit in itself. But then when I started exploring what do some of the other nationhood titles of themselves, whether that's Haudenosaunee, whether that's Cree, whether that's the Lakota people of the plains, Lakota, Dakota, and the Stoney people, they all start meaning the same thing. They're referencing just simply being human being.
Yeah.
So when my eldest used to say, only the Anishinaabe can go into Sweat Lodge, I used to always question that, but when I look at a universal language of English, they're really saying only human beings can go into Sweat Lodge. So then by virtue of that, our cultural practices are meant to be inclusive, that all human beings are able to go into the Sweat Lodge. If they say only Anishinaabe people can carry a pipe, well, then the universal translation of Anishinaabe means human being, then human beings can carry a pipe. So all people are entitled to carry a pipe if they're spiritual, if they're human. And by virtue of the universal language, we all carry those abilities. So we unpack a lot of that for people, for a lot of our staff, and to start realizing we're all indigenous. We just have these languages that are part of our geography and part of our colonization, then that starts creating a separation amongst us.
Yeah, and the separation is becoming the us versus them, and
yes.
You know, that's not our way, that's
yes.
not our practice, and it really gets in the way of unification and people working
yeah.
with people in a really good way. And that kind of goes counter against indigenous teachings, where it is about how do you be a good human being. and you know, and these are the kinds of discussions that I think are really important for us to share and to talk like this, because I think so often people want to exclude it. I know that happens a lot in my own culture, in Haudenosaunee culture, where, well, you know that I carry a long pipe. And I've worked with that long pipe for many, many years. It's actually my third pipe. It's not even the first pipe. It's my third pipe that I've had to had years and years of teachings with in order to hold it, carry it, work with it, and now do healing practices with it. That took I'm going to say half my life. You know, I'm in my 60s now. I started probably when I was in my mid-30s. And so, yeah, it's like half my life of teachings and sitting and listening and practicing and feeling this way and removing all of any obstacles of pain or hurt that I might have had that would have made me want to exclude people, which is excluding is going against the inclusiveness. Of where the language is, you say everybody, it belongs to all human beings. Everybody can have a pipe. Everybody can have a drum. I think one of the elders down here, I remember her saying, all cultures have drums. They have their own drums, and so do we. And you know, and
yeah.
people across in European countries, they have drums that they use in their practices. So it isn't just us. It's just a little different way of using those. Basic tools, I think, that everybody has been given. And that's the part I think we forgot about, isn't it? We forgot about the spiritual part, which is the energy that includes us. Does, you know, it's not about the cultural practice per se or what language you speak, but it's about the universal spirit and the oneness of that spirit or the oneness of that creation. That's kind of how I see it and how I think you're explaining it as well.
Yeah, that summed up a lot of what I'm talking about very well there, and that's the biggest part in all of this is the act of colonization that we've all engaged in. And First Nations people are part, I want to say just as guilty of it, but it's not by our own doing. We've been colonized just like all people throughout the world have been colonized, and that's one of the pieces we unpack for all staff here when they come in is each staff has to talk about what their historical origins are. And a lot of them want to say, I'm Canadian or I'm from New Brunswick. And I'm like, no, you're not from Canada. That's a modern construct that just goes back to the the early 60s and early developments of our country here that we know it. And I said, your family lineage goes back to a different place. And when you start looking back and going back to those places, you start realizing that all cultures have been colonized. It just happened at a much earlier point than what happened to First Nations people. And that colonization is, at its core definition, is the act of moving from the heart, which is where our soul and our spirit lies, in the center of our chest, and being locked into the head, going into the brain where the ego lies. And that's where colonization is rooted in. It's rooted in this idea of being locked into the mind. And the mind wants to focus on processes, steps. It wants to tell you that there are 10 steps to carrying a pipe. You first have to light it with a match, and that match has to be wood, and it can't be a lighter, and then it has to be turned in a certain way, and then it has to be held in a certain way. We start regionizing our processes, which is the act of getting caught up in the mind, thinking that there are a set of steps that have to be followed in engaging in a spiritual practice. So those are critical. We're all guilty of it, no matter what society we come from, and First Nations included. And then we have to be mindful of the original intent of all the aspects or all the gifts that have been given to us in creation, is that there's spirit comes first. When we look at the medicine wheel, there's the teaching that spirit is first. Spirit comes first and foremost, and spirit comes last. It's that full circle that it starts with spirit and it ends with spirit.
Yeah,
but
we come from the spirit world, and we'll go back there in the end.
Yeah, that's true.
We
lost that with drums, with our pipes, with our ceremonies. We get lost in the idea of spirit being first and spirit being last. The colonization is everything in between, and that's what happens in life. From that first moment we're born, at the start of life, those first 4 years, we start becoming into the mind, and we get stuck there for a long period of time until that time of going back home, that we start realizing spirit is again the core and the most important piece.
So I like what you're saying, Craig, because it pushes our conversation up to another level, because I think some people look at Native traditional healing practices as just coming to heal the physical sicknesses and the emotional pains and the traumas that our people have lived through. But what you're talking about is, let's look at the beliefs and the mental constructs that we've created in our minds, that even the mind itself, the mental beliefs that we follow in the mental what would you call them, beliefs, values, and attitudes that we've created or that we hold to be true inside of ourselves may not be true at all, or we think we're Indigenous, but it may not be in line with Indigenous people's thinking or the way that our original attitudes, values, and beliefs were carried out and held. And so you're talking about decolonization of the mind somewhere. So it's not just healing. Traditional healing isn't just about physical disease and plant medicine, even though that's what our example was today. And it's not just about emotional healing and unburdening yourself. It also includes looking at your ideas, looking at where do these ideas come from and how are they implanted and how might they be not in line with a more inclusive worldview. And that's what I really like about what you're saying. And people, I think, don't think about healing on that level at all. But that's also part of the Native traditional healing practices as well. I guess you'd call it like a Native psychologist, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that very much, again, sums it up. It's colonization is the act of being stuck in the mind. And all people, all nations, all people are guilty of this. It's just a part of our human structure. It's that idea of what came first, the chicken or the egg. And we've always known historically as Indigenous people that its spirituality came first, but we move towards that idea of the physical constructs or the physical relevance or importance of life. And it's a part of it, but it's not the most important. It's just a segment of it. And that medicine wheel teaches us of those four equal quadrants, that the spiritual component in that plays an equal role to the mental, which is where the mind lies, to the physical, which is our body, to the to the emotional, which is our thoughts and our feelings and all of those pieces. But most often, always when we're looking at when I look at performance reviews, we discuss the four parts of being, and just talk about that, not in a cultural construct, but just in a human construct. What are the pieces that are missing? And more often than not, the staff are recognized that they need to engage in an equal level or a higher level of spiritual engagement. We often forget those pieces. And that becomes prevalent in society, in academic disciplines, that there's always a notion that it's the mind that comes first, and we need to focus on that and let that be a part of the decision-making process and everything that we do. But a lot of times we forget about the heart, we forget about that spirit that's there forever trying to guide us into making the proper decisions.
Mm-hmm. So Craig, can I put you on the spot for just one question and a little bit of time that we have left here before we end? What do you think about the Pope's visit, and how is that helping Indigenous or not helping Indigenous peoples in terms of the truth and reconciliation process, or that Native people, you know, are saying that it's necessary, right, that we not just get the truth out of what happened with residential schools and everything to our cultures, our people, but also there has to be reconciliation. There has to be more than an apology, people are saying. And then I know a lot of people, I've been talking to a lot of people recently since the headdress. That's what kind of upset people, was when they put a headdress on the Pope. I just wondered what your view was about that.
That's a big question. It's something I've actually been reflecting on quite a bit the last couple of days, and if not the last year, since the uncovering of the graves throughout all of Canada and the numerous unmarked graves that have been found throughout the residential schools in the various provinces. But when we look at truth and reconciliation, there's two key words in there, and a lot of people don't unpack that word truth. They don't realize what that fully means. And the first part of it is that when they're looking at an apology, there has to be truth tied to that apology. There has to be a sincerement. The person has to be talking from their spirit. And there's a very distinct difference between someone praying from the mind and someone mm-hmm. praying from the heart and spirit. And when you're engaged in spiritual practice and when you're in the presence of our seers, they can tell very clearly in terms of their energy whether they're being sincere or not, whether they're speaking from the mind or speaking from the heart. So yeah, that idea of truth becomes very relevant in an apology and in the words that are being said. So there's that first question comes to mind: is he being truthful in the words that he is sharing? Meaning that, is he speaking from the heart? The next part that comes from that lets you know whether someone is being truthful is the actions that follow, or the actions that they carry, and how they go about doing what it is they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And to be an acknowledgement or a change in the behavior within that whole segment of religion, Catholicism and Christianity, and that whole piece that is represented by the Pope, and the truth, if we're not looking at the ability to see and to look at his energy and whether he's being honest and truthful or not, we're going to see it in the actions that follow. And that's the piece that concerns me the most. I'm not convinced that there is a sincerity and that there's a truth being spoken through his words, because there was absence of certain words being spoken when he was giving his speeches, which leads me to understand or believe that it's an absence because of the realities of the legal system, and that words can words would have a big legal effect if he were to acknowledge certain pieces. So I'm really struggling with the appearance that it looks like a very mindful presentation and visit, and it's a very superficial visit. And I don't know if there's a lot of truth to what's going on. And that's the last part is reconciliation. There can only be reconciliation if truth is at the forefront. And I'm left with not firmly believing whether that's present.
Yeah, that's a great answer, Craig. You can tell you've put a lot of thoughtful reflection into giving your answer here today, and it's a good one. And I think a lot of Native people across Canada are having to equally sit and reflect and say, you know, what does this mean? And I know it's stirred the pot a lot of ways, right? Because a lot of people are saying, well, you know, when they put the headdress on, why are they honoring someone who's caused so much pain, right? Who's created, and whether in his institution that he represents, he's the figurehead for, you know, why are you doing that? Why are you honoring somebody that has created so much strife and so much pain and suffering and for Native people? And so there's a lot of reflection that's going to have to, you know, go on about that. And a lot of this word, which a lot of people, they don't like, they get mad at, was the word forgiveness. And that has to be unpacked too, I think, sometimes when we have to look at, you know, you can forgive, but do you necessarily have to forget, or do you hold somebody accountable? Maybe he himself is not responsible, but is what he represents accountable? How can you be accountable for what happened in the past, and then work with Native people in the future to bring about that reconciliation or reparation of some of the suffering? And And how can you help that process, and how can you help people to heal, which is what coming back again to Native traditional healing practices. And lots to be said, because I'm not quite sure that the healing has, you know, it's going to take a while, I think. It's going to take a certain period of time for people to really move to a place of forgiveness, which I think is also, if we look at reconciliation, part of that concept too, right?
So
that's lots. It's a big question, like you said, but I always like to bring it up, and I always like to throw something out there, just, you know, because it stimulates my thinking too.
Yeah.
You and I can talk for a long, long time, Craig. I know I'll never forget the 4-hour breakfast meeting.
Yeah.
And you and I can certainly, you know, visit this idea again. But I want to thank you for coming on the show today and really putting out some good concepts that I want to follow up in subsequent shows. I know Errol and I ended up doing a series because we got talking about ideas and concepts that just in having a conversation, say you and I or you and Errol, you know, people benefit from hearing these kinds of notions because people just don't necessarily think about that, right? And I get it if you're suffering and you're hurting and your family has been treated badly and that suffering still remains in some ways inside of us, I can get that you wouldn't necessarily be, you know, able to hear certain concepts or think of certain ideas, which are really, really, truly embedded into ancient indigenous knowledges and the systems and the practices. So I just want to thank you for coming on the air today. And maybe I can convince you to come on a future show and we can continue on the conversation because there's just so much to explore in this topic of Native traditional healing and all of its practices. So I'll just thank you.
I appreciate the invite, Diane. I always enjoy our talks, and I'm very passionate about Indigenous practice in a modern setting, so I appreciate the opportunity to talk about our agency today and a little bit of the work that we're doing here on Manitoulin Island.
Well, you're welcome, Craig. And like I said, I'll probably be phoning you up and connecting with you again and seeing if I can get you on a future show.
All right. Thank you, Diane.
Okay. Thanks, Craig. Take care. Have a good afternoon.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.